So, Kelsey, I'd like to start this episode with a twist because we have Stuart Turton as our guest today. Stuart Turton is famously known for fusing locked room mysteries with literary fiction, sci-fi, fantasy, and horror. He is the author of The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, The Devil in the Dark Water, and the recent Library Reads pick for May, The Last Murder at the End of the World. His books are bestsellers in both the UK and the US and have been translated into 40 languages and have sold over 1 million copies. I love a fun author biography, and Stuart Turton's bio on Goodreads is a gem. So, Stuart, I have to ask, what would you like our listeners to know about you?
Nothing they can't not immediately deduce. I'm British. I'm from the North. I don't take anything very seriously. I am still completely baffled that I'm actually an author. Like, most mornings I wake up and that startles me anew. So, yeah, just, you know, I'm like a startled animal. Just treat me cautiously.
So, of course, we're delighted to have you as our guest today. Welcome to the first 50 pages, Stuart.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, your books are loved by mystery readers and mystery authors alike. And we recently interviewed author Benjamin Stevenson, and he named The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle as one of his favorite books. One of the things that I think we readers, librarians, mystery lovers are impressed with in your writing is the intricate structure and the care that you take in crafting your story. Your books are not a cozy kind of read. They are often referred to as high-concept mysteries, where you're able to fuse elements from multiple genres into the murder mystery. Your latest book is a perfect example of this kind of high-concept mystery. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about The Last Murder at the End of the World?
Have you got 4 hours?
Yeah.
I'll try and do the four-hour speech in 2 minutes. It's set 90 years after the world has ended. So everybody's dead. Everyone you love, everyone I love, us, we're all dead. 122 people survived, and they're living on a small Greek island. The world was wiped out by a black fog that just erupted out of the ground and swallowed everything. But this island's got a barrier around it, and that's keeping everyone safe. But it is a dystopia, but this island is a utopia. There's no arguments, there's no violence. Everyone on the island, 122 people who survived, are selfless and kind and loving and lovely. And they've never, ever heard of murder. They've never heard of violence. And then one day, one of the number turns up dead. And it's up to the only sort of curious member of this village to work out who's doing the killing. And it's a really fun little island, but the strange things that do abound. So there is a voice in everyone's head that's talking to them. It can hear their thoughts. It tells them what to do. There are places on the island they're not allowed to go to. And there's a curfew. So at 6:30 every evening, they fall asleep wherever they are and whatever they're doing. So yeah, it's a book filled with mysteries, mysteries piled upon mysteries.
I'm not giving anything away by saying that the narrator's name is Abby. We don't see Abby, but they're always there with the villagers, a benevolent, omniscient, and unexplained voice in their heads. And it's just such an interesting device for telling the story, driving the story of the inhabitants of this island. So my question is, how did you land on telling the story from this point of view?
The funny thing about Abby is that every time I do an interview, people are like, oh, Abby, this is a really unusual narrator. And I'm like, yeah, but it's just the Victorian narrator, right? The Victorian omniscient narrator. This is what all books were doing up until about 1850 or something. They were all written like this. And then it completely fell out of fashion and people stopped doing it because they thought it was naff. And I've just brought it back. And the way I brought it back is because I read those books and I love those books and I love that point of view. And I understand why readers fell out of love with it. But for this story, I like the idea of having an omniscient narrator. I like the idea of the voice in their heads that heard all their thoughts making this murder impossible. Like, this murder should not happen because this voice knows what they're all doing. It knows what they're all planning. And it should be able to warn the people who need to be warned before it ever happens. So for me, that was an incredible plotting challenge, right? To write a murder in which all the characters in it are selfless and kind and lovely and have no reason to commit a murder. And there's an omniscience which is taking care of them, which also should prevent the murder. So me getting to mess around with that and plot something where that didn't matter and where that was thwarted. It was so fun for me to do. And that's generally always what I'm trying to do with my books. I'm just trying to entertain myself before I entertain other people, because I've got to sit with this thing for 2 years. Like, and if I'm even one day of it bores me, I am so good a procrastinator that I will not go back to it for 2 months. So I've just got to make sure every time I'm sitting down, I'm entertained and there's something in the writing for me to be excited by. And Abby was just a really exciting challenge, but also a really exciting character to explore and get down on the page.
Before becoming a famous author, you spent time as a technology journalist. How did that experience impact the story?
Oh, let's first quibble with the idea of famous author. Let's just really, there's about 17 people on this planet who know where I'm very famous amongst those 17 people. Right? But beyond that, I, you know, as a middling, somewhat in the center of the pack author, I was a technology journalist. That's where it's interesting, because usually for my novels, I spend 3 months planning them out. And I travel a lot in that process. I usually go. So for Devil in the Dark Water, my second novel, I traveled to Amsterdam because they built this huge boat. And that was the boat I based the boat in the book on. And I climbed all over that thing for 3 days. I went out to Indonesia. In Seven Deaths, my first novel, I'm sorry, the Seven and a Half Deaths, my first novel, I crawled around in country houses, and I went over to France, and I had a big Tudor house all to myself for like 2 weeks. And I went exploring that with a candle at midnight. So I'd always try to do this very in-depth research and put myself in the places I need to be. But when I started writing this book, it was the pandemic. So I couldn't go anywhere. I was just stuck at home. So I ended up going back through my old articles. So my old articles from being a travel journalist and my old articles from being a technology journalist. And I started looking at the people I'd been talking to, what the technology they'd been working on, what they were telling me was coming, what's in the future, what they assume will be the next big thing. So most of the technology in this book is what somebody in the past has told me they are working on. So as odd as some of those technologies may seem when you're reading them, they're all true, they're all based in fact, and someone around the world is currently working on them. And it's the same with the travel journalism. I needed the travel journalism to give me that reminder of what, you know, I'm from England, I should point out, so like heat on the skin, what that feels like. We don't get a lot of that in England, so I needed to be refreshed about it by reading my own works and, you know, going swimming in beautiful, clear, salty water. And all of these things that I got from being a travel journalist, they're all in the book because I went back and read my old articles and sort of refreshed myself on what those things were. It's a really odd research process. I don't recommend it.
I think that would be like the perk of the job, right? To get to travel and have, you know, salt water and sunshine. And
oh, exactly. That was like the best part of my job, was to do those things. And when the pandemic hit, I was like, oh, I get to sit at home now and do the same job off Google. Terrible. Terrible.
I'm not a tech librarian, but I do find myself drawn to articles about emerging technology, especially artificial intelligence and how it can and will impact our world. And it is all happening very, very quickly. At turns, I am excited and terrified by the future. Do you have any thoughts on how AI will affect our capacity to write stories, or even our capacity to trust the writing of stories?
It's a really interesting thing. So one of the people I was talking to when I was, as I said, when I was a technology journalist, they were working on I don't even know what you'd call it, an algorithm basically that would be built into your Kindle e-reader or any sort of e-reader. And the idea would be that you would tell it how long your commute was. So if you get on a train in the morning or you get in your car in the morning, you would tell it takes me 15 to 20 minutes to get to work. And this thing would then write you a story that you could read in 20 minutes. Or, you know, you could tell it you want to read it over the course of a week and it would create chapters, or it would create increments of the story that could be read in 20 minutes. It was very clever and I could see it being very attractive. But as I talked to more people, there is just this bias against artificial intelligence as a writer. There's a bias, a general bias against the idea that artificial intelligence will create something creative for them to enjoy. They immediately shut down. So I don't think it will ever take off, just because I don't think readers will ever accept it. I think even if the story felt like something a human put together, the moment they knew that it was an artificial intelligence, they would turn their back on it. And there's something reassuring about that. I think that's my industry and that's my profession.
Yeah.
So this book is a locked room mystery. So for our listeners, this means there is something to figure out, but it has restrictions. The explanation can only exist within a very limited set of answers. And that's part of what makes this style of mystery so exciting. They're often harder to solve, and the creativity involved that makes them so, so fun. The Last Murder at the End of the World also nods to these stories from the golden age of science fiction. Literary classics like 1984, iRobot. No spoilers, of course, but it would serve readers well to look up Isaac Asimov's Three Rules of Robotics as they are reading. What inspired you to bring these sci-fi elements into a locked door mystery?
It was sort of fortuitous. When I first started writing this, the first thing I needed, I always create locked something. So my first novel was a locked house mystery, my second one was locked boat mystery, and this is my locked island mystery. It's really difficult to lock a lot of people on an island. How do you make sure they can't come and go? It's a basic plotting challenge. And I came up with this idea of the fog. But once you have the fog, you've got to explain where did the fog come from? What's it doing? And that automatically led to me to the wiped out world. It led me to the apocalypse. It led me to this utopian dystopia. And the more I sort of built into that, the more I realized I was beginning to write a sci-fi book. That's how it happened. It was almost accidental. I needed this thing to make my murder mystery work. And the thing that serviced that was a very sci-fi concept. So I started leaning into it. The problem with that, of course, is that the more you lean into it, the more your novel stops being a crime novel and becomes a sci-fi novel. And as much as I love sci-fi, I didn't want to write a sci-fi novel. I wanted to write a crime novel with sci-fi elements. So the trick was always, you just named all those amazing authors. It was to cherry-pick from their work and to cherry-pick the themes and to cherry-pick the things that were recognizable to even the most general readers of science fiction, people who don't go in depth in it, that would give the flavor to my novel of that stuff without wholly diving headfirst into it. So hopefully we got there, but I am occasionally aware that I felt myself all through the writing thinking, oh no, I've just turned it to a sci-fi book again. I've got a robot, crime book again. It's, you know, it is safe waters.
And I do think that in this book, part of that influence is in the exploration of those existential questions, you know, exploring the insights into our existence. You know, like I really feel that nod to that speculative fiction there.
Oh, thanks so much. Because it was funny, because I'm sure every author who says this when they come on, you don't really start writing with themes in mind. You have a plot, you have some characters, and you get going. And then the themes sort of emerge and you start to see them yourself as you write them, and you're like, oh yeah, so that's what I'm writing about. Okay, cool. And then you kind of carry on going with it. And I think there is something about sci-fi in particular that lends, crime does this all the time, because crime is obviously about crime and punishment. And for me, it's always been about redemption. Like Christie usually took her novels up to the point of punishment. The evil doer is found, they are punished, the novel ends, everybody applauds. I'm always bothered about what happens to them afterwards. I'm always worried about the redemption of those people and what we expect of them once they're caught, and if there's anything they can do to come back to us and come back to society. So that always finds its way in my novels, and it's a very large part of this novel with a character called Adil. But the other side of it, the science fiction side, that automatically started steering me towards humanity and these issues facing us, and again, ecological crises and all the rest of it. But not to get too heavy, but like it was really, really fun just to have an excuse to sort of talk about that stuff and lean into it and make it the background texture of my novel, because you want that. I want to give readers things that they find if they dig. So the deeper they go into the novel, the more things they're going to find that hopefully interest them. Or you can just be happy with the murder mystery, and that will work equally well.
As I was reading this book, the one theme that I was drawn to, you know, is the idea of what makes us humanity, right? Like, you know, emotion, memory. And I think you do tackle it in such an interesting way. You know, at one point, one of the characters in the book says that emotion is an evolutionary failure. And that kind of stopped me for a second, and it made me think about it. So, like, for the rest of the day, I was like, well, what do I think about that? Like, you know, and the idea for these villagers that murder is such an incomprehensible act within, you know, this community of survivors. So, I don't know if it's probably a duh question, but is emotion at the heart of every murder mystery?
I actually don't think it is. I think if you read Christie, emotion's almost secondary to what's going on. It's not, it may even be tertiary. Often what happens in an Agatha Christie is that she reduces everything to cogs and wheels in the mystery. So all the characters, and especially as she goes along in her canon, the characters just become cogs. They lose their humanity. They become things to get Poirot or Marple onto the next clue. Or they become exposition delivery devices. They're just there to deal out. And I think what happened with her was that she realized that her readers only wanted the final 10 pages. They only wanted the conclusion. So everything before that, they were rushing through to try and get to the conclusion. And she was writing 2 to 3 of these novels a year. And I think she's almost the first, almost like, you know, professional author, in the sense that she just looked at her audience. What do they want? I'll just give them tons of that. So 3 novels a year, 2 novels a year. Here's the final 10 pages you care about. Here's some pages before they get to the final 10 pages. Job done. Over. And that bothers me. Like, I genuinely am bothered about the motion of these people. I genuinely am bothered about why they do these things and what happens to them when they do them. And I'm genuinely bothered by the role of the investigator as well. Who are these people who are compelled to solve these crimes, and what do they give up to do it? What does it cost them, and what do they get out of it?
So your debut novel, The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, was a runaway hit, loved by readers and critics alike all around the world, and then us included. In the all-encompassing category of the mystery genre, this book has been called ingenious and original time and time again. And I was just talking with a patron this week who said that she loved this book and had never read anything like it before. Your stories are complex, there are lots of characters to keep track of, and to quote Kirkus Reviews, keenly calibrated twists and turns. And as of this week, there were over 51,000 reviews on Goodreads for this book. After all that's been said about this book over the last 6 years, is there anything more to add?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you want to be grateful, but you don't want to be bound by it. And I think when it first came out, all anybody wanted from me was the 8 deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. People just wanted me to keep telling this sort of story over and over again. And that's why my second novel, The Devil in the Dark Water, was such a profound reaction against that. It was an historical murder mystery set in 1632 with a lot of historical research. Because I wanted people to know that that's not what I was going to do, that I was going to switch on you all the time. And every time you picked up one of my books, everything would be a mystery. Everything can be a mystery, where it's set, who these characters are, what kind of world we're in, what the time period is. That was the career I sort of maybe arrogantly foresaw for myself when I wrote 7 Deaths. This is what I wanted to be doing. I wanted to be changing up all the time and writing radically different things all the time.
We know that you changed the title in the US to The 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, but it actually is The 7 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. Can you share a little bit more about why you changed the title for the US publication?
Yeah, because there's another book, which I'm sure everyone's aware of, called The 7 Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, which is totally and completely enormous. And when The 7 Deaths came out in the UK, it was about 6 or 7 months before it came out in the US. So 7 Husbands came out in the intervening time, and my US publisher got a little bit worried, because obviously nobody knows who I am, nobody had ever heard of this book, and 7 Husbands was coming out, and they were worried that my book would get, you know, completely trampled underneath this name, or people would be confounded by it. So we had this, I think, honestly, it lasted for about 3 months, this back and forth where we were trying to come up with a new title for 7.5 Deaths. But this is the perfect title for the book. I don't think there was nothing else that got near to being as good a title for it. And eventually the conversation got so silly and the titles got so ridiculous that the chief executive of Sourcebooks, my US publisher, had to step in and be like, we're calling it the 7.5 death. It's done. This conversation is over. And obviously the title change did not work. It has never worked. This question haunts me. Nobody knows why we changed the title. Everyone's still completely confused by this and the Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. There's a story I tell a lot, but which is very charming. I was at a festival once, and a little old man turned up, and he'd bought the Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, the 7.5 Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, and the Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, because he thought they were a trilogy. Aww. And he bought them. I know. And he'd bought them for his daughter. Aww. And I didn't have the heart to tell him, so I just signed them all from me, including Seven Husbands, and sent them on his way. So I'd love to know. If his daughter is listening, I'd love to know what she thought of that as she tried to go through the trilogy and realize two of the books were the same. Very postmodern trilogy.
Yeah.
Well, and as librarians, I personally have had that experience. You know, readers hear about a title or their friend tells them a book and they come to you with bits and pieces of the title. So usually I just say, are you looking for the mystery? Like, okay, yeah. I know which one you want, and then we find it. But if you've got another couple minutes, we'd love to know more about your favorite books. Can we talk about the books that have had the most impact on you, either just as a human or in your work as a writer?
Yeah, it's funny. Both things are the same, right? Like being a human, being a writer, because when you write, it is that humanity. It's all that stuff you've built up through reading, through loving this form that sort of comes out. It is, I always liken it to a toolbox, right? Like I've read a ton of books across a lot of different genres, and that's put different tools into my toolbox. So when I'm writing and I'm struggling and I need an emotion or I need a bit of exposition or I need to ramp up the tension, I go and look in the toolbox. I go and look at the books that did that brilliantly. And now I have this sort of index card in my head of all these different things. So, you know, if I want to heighten up the tension, I'll go and look at my favorite thrillers. If I want to do a locked room, I'll go and look at my favorite locked rooms. When I want a bit of romance, I can go and look at my favorite romances. You need that, and you need it almost over the course of your life. It's not something you can't decide to be an author and then decide you want to read a load of books to learn how to do it. You need to have been reading your entire life, and you need to have sort of taken on that information and those structures almost by osmosis, and then they are stored somewhere deep inside of you. It's really interesting. But for me, when I am really stuck, when I'm really, really stuck, it's The God of Small Things by Arunati Roy is one of the books I always go back to. And I read that probably once a year, but when I'm stuck, I will read a page or two pages or three pages of that novel. And it will always give me a little jolt because the writing is so beautiful and the structure is so unusual and the story is so compelling that it will just do something. It'll kind of like jumpstart my brain every single time. It's perfect. Otherwise, The Book Thief is a book that stays with me by Marcus Zusak. I've read that a couple of times, and that is a really, really special book. They're the two, I think. They're the two I always revisit.
Very cool. Yeah, I remember reading The God of Small Things. Now I'm kind of like, I need to go back to read that again.
What I found with that novel is that it plays differently depending on your stage in life. So for me, I read that when I was 20, I think 22, and traveling. And it hit completely different. I was really involved with there's two children in that. So it's a familial, it's a story about a family. And I was really taken by the kids in the story because they're around my age, and it gets to them being a bit older, but it's about the mistakes that they've made and how they reconnect. And now I'm a bit older, I'm connecting more with the mother figure and the sort of, you know, the older figures in the story. And there's a grandparent in there, and I'm terrified. I'm like, the moment I read that book and I connect with the grandparent, that's when I'll know I'm old. That's going to be my marker. So, yeah, that book is astonishing. It's incredibly beautiful, and it's got something to say at every stage that you will read it. So, yeah, that's my favorite book of all time.
I would agree. I think the best books are the ones that we can read over and over at different stages of life. And, you know, they can present completely new insights, you know, in the story. And Yeah, I would definitely agree.
So
wonderful. This would have been a very, like, you know, acrimonious end to a podcast if you disagreed and we started a big fight about it. Imagine that. Imagine.
So we have to know, since you are a very avid reader, what is currently on your to-be-read list?
To-be-read. I'm just finishing off All the Colours of Dark, which is the new Chris Whitaker novel, which is astonishing. I highly recommend that to absolutely everybody. And next on my list is, what am I reading after this? Oh, the new Chris Brookmeyer, The Cracked Mirror. So I'll be moving on to that shortly after this. But they're two proofs. So once you get published, all people ever do is send you proofs of new novels. I guess you guys are the same. And they send you a proof and they're like, hey, do you want to say something nice about this? And now there's about 400 of them. And basically, you're going to put a mattress on top of them. You use my bed.
Kind of work them into your home decor.
Yeah, exactly. So what I need to do is, once I've got through those, which are brilliant novels, but what I want to do is just wander into my local library and just have a very slow peruse around the shelves and just find something that I've not heard of before that just leaps out at me. They're always my favorite discoveries.
Well, that's a perfect answer.
At the library. I'll just go to a different one.
Everyone's different and has its own personality.
You kind of alluded to this earlier, and I love that you kind of told us the insight behind the cover art of your book and kind of where that came from. But the Last Murder at the End of the World is really an attractive book. It is the kind of book you want to own in a print version. At least I do. It's the kind of book that you want to have on your bookshelf for other curious readers to pick up and ask you about. You know, it's often these little details that create delight in readers. And we're fortunate enough to have, you know, this early copy of this book. And I've had several people comment to me about how cool they think the teal edging of the pages is and the embossed title and the colors. And I just wanted to mention that because it is such an eye-catching book. And I love that you shared, you know, kind of where that came from.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I mean, so much that none of that is me. So obviously, like, I'm very blessed that I have these amazing people around me, these amazing designers, and these amazing, there's a beautiful map inside it as well. And there's nothing better than when you finish something like that and your creativity and your act of imagination sparks the imagination of other people. It's so wonderful. And then it comes back to you and you're like, I know that my words have created that, but it feels so distinct from me. It feels like someone else has created a work of art because I, you know, wrote a book, which is just fantastic. And I think it's very rare that you see a murder mystery that looks like this, that it has these colors, that is this different, that has this lightness to it. And I think it's completely genius on the part of my cover designer, David Mann, and my publisher, Sourcebooks, to put those sprayed edges, which I know in the US are not a huge thing in crime. So for them to be that bold and to believe in it that much is so wonderful.
And we know that readers will devour this story and then anxiously await what is next. And we hear that it might be a more contemporary thriller kind of thing.
Yeah, I think this was always the plan a little bit, that I started off in the 1920s with 7.5 deaths, and then I took myself back to 1632, and then I've gone into the future now. So it naturally feels like the only sort of time period left to write in, if I don't want to repeat myself, is something a bit more contemporary. But it's me. So what I'm thinking about now and what I'm planning out now probably won't be the same thing that I delivered in 3 years. It just won't be, because the ideas keep shifting and I get interested in new things, and the first draft never works for me. I always end up throwing out my first draft completely and starting again, because the thing that seems such a great idea when I was plotting it out doesn't work on paper or isn't as entertaining as I hoped it would be. So if I told you about it now, I'd just be lying directly to you, and I definitely do not want to do that. So I'm gonna keep it a secret for the minute.
Thank you for being our guest today, Stuart. It has been a great and wonderful conversation.
No, I've had a blast. Thank you so much for having me on.